This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Jack Beatty. When Osama bin Laden threatens America in the name of the Palestinian cause, some in the West Bank cheer, but some cringe. Still others see in the war on terrorism an opportunity to finally carve out a Palestinian state. But after a grim, year-long intifada that has stacked up casualties on both sides, negotiations will be tricky, to say the least. In 1991, Israelis and Palestinians were also at an impasse in the first intifada. Then, Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat sided with Saddam Hussein in the Gulf War. It was a disaster for the Palestinians, politically, economically, morally. In this U.S.-led war on terrorism, it appears Arafat doesn't intend to make the same mistake twice.
It's high time to put an end to the Israeli occupation, to put an end to the conflict between the two sides, to establish a Palestinian independent state with East Jerusalem, which we call Holy Noble Jerusalem, as its capital.
إلى جانب دولة إسرائيل.
A Palestinian state next to the state of Israel.
وذلك حتى يتمكن أطفالنا وأطفالهم وشعبنا وشعبهم وكافة شعوب المنطقة في الشرق الأوسط من العيش بأمن وسلام واستقرار.
So our children and their children, our people and their people, and all the people of the Middle East region can live in peace, security, and stability.
We're talking about the growing pressure to settle the Palestinian question. For decades, Yasser Arafat led what many in the West regarded as a terrorist campaign against Israel. But after the September 11th attacks on the U.S., Arafat has positioned himself with the West in the war on terrorism. But is he taking too much of a risk with his own people? What are U.S. interests in Israel now that it's at war with terrorists? You can join the conversation at 800-423-TALK, 800-423-8255. With us now is Hisham Sharabi, chairman of the Center for Policy Analysis on Palestine. He joins us from Washington, and here in our studio is Jeff Jacoby, columnist for the Boston Globe. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Jack.
Hi.
Welcome, welcome. Dr. Sharabi, let's start with you. Do you see a window of opportunity opening for peace in the Middle East?
I do. If the initiative that the Bush administration seems to be preparing for, one that would activate the peace process, and as President Bush said, that would lead to the establishment of a Palestinian state.
And what is the content of this peace process? There's been some talk here of something beyond a Palestinian state, a Palestinian homeland. Can you tell us what that is, what that initiative would be, and how that would differ from, say, past U.S. proposals?
I wish I could answer that. We're hoping that it would be beyond a homeland, and it will be a state. You know, when Israel was established, originally in the Balfour Declaration, the Balfour Declaration promised to have to facilitate a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine, quote unquote, without affecting the rights of the indigenous population. We don't want that. We want what Israel has now, a state. Palestine has been our homeland, still is, but now Palestinians want an independent sovereign state alongside Israel.
And do you think that the year of violence that has since taken place how has that affected prospects for peace? Up until the September 11th crisis, it was thought that peace was distant, more distant than ever before. How has September 11th changed things?
Again, this is a difficult question to answer. What the awful events of September 11th have brought about, not only in Palestine, Israel, but in the entire Middle East, the Muslim world, and for that matter, globally. So the situation has radically changed. Now, there are new sensitivities, new fears, feelings of vulnerability, which is global. The Bush administration is faced with really historic turning points, options that will affect not only the region, the Middle East, but the world. So what we're talking about is it possible for the American administration to approach this crisis in a way that would be not only military, not only the result of overwhelming force, vengeance, that is being done right now. Mm-hmm. What we're hoping for is that there will be approaches that are diplomatic, political, mm-hmm. Economic, that would address the grievances, and these are many in the region. Mm-hmm. These should be explored.
Give us briefly some of the grievances, a picture of the grievances that and how the U.S. can address them.
Right. Three kinds, three types. There is the economic. This is one of the most richest regions in the world. And you have the most wretched, impoverished population in the world. And it's growing. And the gap between rich and poor is widening. Two, it is a part of the world in which there's a great deal of talk about democracy, about human rights. And in practically every regime in the Arab world and the Muslim world, you have dictators, you have traditionalist patriarchies, you have undemocratic regimes. And many of these are supported by the United States, mm-hmm. have been.
Mm-hmm.
The third is the specific Arab-Israeli conflict. In many ways, this summarizes in microcosm the basic heart of the matter of grievances. Mm-hmm. This is where humiliation, a crushed, humiliated population in its own homeland mm-hmm. is reduced to before the entire Arab Muslim world to a situation in which they're daily bombarded, their houses demolished, their little remaining land being settled by settlers, colonial settlers,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and prevented from the rights that have been recognized by the United Nations, by the United States, and by international opinion.
We get that picture, and thank you for it. Jeff Jacoby, Prime Minister Sharon retracted his statement that the U.S. was appeasing the Arab states by promising, in what form we don't know, to accelerate, to reinvigorate a new peace process. Do you think he was right the first time? Are we appeasing the Arab states by doing this?
The answer is yes and no. There's appeasement, but it's not appeasement of the kind that was taking place in Munich in 1938. In other words, it hasn't been the purpose of the United States to try to stop an aggressive dictator from gobbling up the territory of innocent countries. The appeasement, if that's the word for it, and clearly it wasn't the mot juste, but the appeasement, such as it is designed to keep the Arab and the Muslim world aligned with the United States in this war against Afghanistan, against Osama bin Laden, against terrorism.
And don't we need that?
We certainly need to work out a way in which we can fight a war against Islamist extremist terrorism and not have the entire Islamic and Arab world blow up against us. But it seems to me, especially listening to our other guests, that it's impossible really to understand what's taking place now without reflecting on what was taking place a year ago. A year ago in the Israel-Palestinian arena, Sharon was not the prime minister. Ehud Barak was. There was no Osama bin Laden crisis taking place. There was no World Trade Center that was monopolizing our thoughts. There was instead an ongoing series of negotiations at Camp David under President Clinton. And by virtually unanimous world account, the deal that was offered to Yasser Arafat and to the Palestinian Authority then by the former Prime Minister Barak gave the Palestinians something like 95% of everything they were looking for. A state, recognized sovereignty, division of Jerusalem, even rights in the Temple Mount and the Old City, which, as you know, have been an extraordinarily painful and difficult thing for the Israelis. And Arafat's response and the response of the Palestinian people to this unprecedented offer, I mean, to repeat, almost virtually 95% of everything they had been seeking, was not to say, we'll take it, where do we sign? It was to launch this incredible war of terror and this intifada that's been going on for the last 12 or 13 months.
You're assuming that he launched it rather than that extremists within the Palestinian state territory.
There is no question that Arafat turns on the terror and turns off the terror at will. When he needs it, he turns it on and he turns it off. The fact is, there is nobody in the world, perhaps today with the exception of bin Laden, who is more the icon of terror and terrorism than Yasser Arafat. And the notion that the United States is going to lead a war against terrorism in which Yasser Arafat is going to be one of the allies is simply surreal. There's something bizarre about it. By the same token, the notion that we're going to fight this war against terrorism in which Israel, the only country in that region of the world that shares America's democratic values, that has fought against Islamist terrorism for so many years, is going to be held at arm's length and not be invited to be a part of it, is also surreal.
But of course, that's a politic judgment, isn't it?
Agreed.
Because Israel's a coalition breaker. They had to do that in the Gulf War as well. And they understand that, don't they?
And it's good that you mentioned the Gulf War, because I think what we ought to be clear on is that there is no more of a connection between the Palestinian issue and the World Trade Center than there was between the Palestinian issue and Saddam invading Kuwait in 1990. Saddam invoked the Palestinian cause because he hoped that this would rally for him the support of the Arab and Muslim world in his fight with the West and with the United States. Bin Laden does the same thing, puts out the videotape in which he talks about the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. It isn't the Palestinians that caused him to cause the death of so many thousands of Americans.
Mr. Shirabi, can you respond to that briefly? 90%
yes.
of what the Palestinians wanted, they could have had a year ago, and they couldn't step up to it. Why? And what's changed?
It's really simple. Mr. Jacoby complicates the story in such a way that I'm sure your listeners are somewhat confused by now. The situation is simply this. Israel is occupying Palestinian lands. The Palestinians have revolted in what is called the Intifada. Their demand is, we want Israel out of our land. End the occupation. Now, there has been a great deal of talk, negotiations. We will end the occupation if this or that happens. The three main elements are this: Jewish settlements in Palestinian lands that have been put in place during the last 10 years, during which peace negotiations were taking place, should be removed.
That's part of the Michel peace initiative, isn't it?
But that's one of the intentions.
But that's a quid pro quo. Remove
right.
the settlements in exchange for ending the terrorism.
Right. And then, of course, there's the question of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is part Arab, part Jewish. Israel has unilaterally against international agreements and United Nations decisions have unified the city of Jerusalem so that you have a city which occupies a little bit more than 10% of Palestinian lands in the West Bank.
I'm afraid, Dr. Shirabi, we have to move on. Thank you so much for your participation.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Will the war on terrorism force a resolution of the Palestinian question? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Jack Beatty. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. Will the war on terrorism force a resolution of the Palestinian question? We're talking with Jeff Jacoby, columnist for the Boston Globe, and I'd also like to bring in Susan Akram. Susan Akram is a professor of law at Boston University. She spent last year teaching at the Palestinian School of Law in East Jerusalem. Welcome, Susan Akram.
Thank you. Good evening.
Good evening. You are an authority on legal matters, I understand.
Yes, specifically on the legal regime having to do with Palestinian refugees. That's what I teach. Mm-hmm. One of the things I teach.
Mm-hmm. You've been to the West Bank. You've been to Israel recently. Do you think that there exists there the sort of human tinder to take a chance for peace? I mean, are the Israelis so beaten down by this year of terrorism that that's just not possible for them? Are the Palestinians, on the other hand, so desperate to retrieve the hopes of Camp David that they're willing to gamble?
Well, I can't speak very much for the Israelis. I haven't spent that much time within Israel. I actually first went to the West Bank in Gaza back in 1988 and have been back and forth since then. I was there during the first Intifada and was shot at by Israeli settlers, I might add, at that time. But I do have many very close Israeli friends, Israeli Jewish friends, and people who I consider have been working very hard for peace within Israel. But my closest ties and most of my work is within the refugee population in Palestine. And one can say, your expression is that are the Israelis too beaten down by terrorism? But on the other hand, the Palestinians feel that they have suffered 52 years of Israeli terrorism. So one must be very careful about making sure that one is looking at the issue from both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my big problems with the dialogue in this country, particularly since I came back from spending a year over there, was really how skewed the dialogue is, talking about terrorism only from the perspective of how it affects Israelis, without taking into account that we have a very lopsided situation with Israeli occupation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the root of the problem for many of us who have studied this issue for so many years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Israeli occupation, you've talked to refugees. Some people think that the reason Arafat didn't go for the deal that was offered in Camp David, the 90% deal that he could have had, was that, in fact, his long-range goal is to eliminate the Jewish state and that he's basically betting on the hatred for Israel in those camps. What do you say to that? Did you encounter much of that just sheer hatred? We want our country. We want Palestine from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean. We want the Jews gone. Did you bump into that? Did you see that?
Well, first of all, I have to. I'm sorry that I take issue with your premise. There was no 90% deal. That's absolutely inaccurate. And I think if you read some of the documents that have since come out of what happened at Camp David, it's very clear that what was being offered was not even 15%, because the settlements were not going to be withdrawn. And if you look at the other resources, the allocation of water, for example, the hold on the best areas of land, Israel was not willing to give any of that up.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, I mean, you must remember that we have 52 years of UN resolutions that very clearly lay down the international
right.
rule of law
right.
that these settlements are illegal.
Right.
Have to start from that premise before trying to answer the rest of your question.
Right. Jeff Jacoby?
I'm struck by the fact that Susan Akram keeps saying 52 years, and it suggests to me, or it makes clear to me, that the real issue for the Palestinian activists is not 1967, it's not Gaza and the West Bank, it's 1948. It's the creation of Israel itself. That's what the objection is to. That's what the objection has always been to. Palestinian Authority documents to this day show a map of what they call Palestine, which encompasses all of present-day Israel. No, the word Israel doesn't appear on it anywhere. throughout the curriculum that's taught to the Palestinian school children. There's this endless litany of hatred and incitement, a constant invocation for them to remember that their whole land has been taken and they must liberate the entire land of Palestine. Over and over and over again, they hear this when they grow up. Is it any wonder, then, that the Palestinians send suicide bombers into pizza shops in Jerusalem and discos in Tel Aviv and blow innocent children and Israelis to kingdom come? You know, I'm struck by the constant invocation of the occupation and the settlements, as though there is something that Israel has failed to do with regard to settlements that was supposed to be a precondition for peace. It's exactly the other way around. The Oslo peace process is now 8 years old. September of 1993, Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat signed the first of the Oslo peace accords, which specified as a precondition, as step number one, that violence was over. Mm-hmm. Arafat and the Palestinian Authority have reiterated over and over and over again, signed repeated documents saying that same point. No more resort to violence, no more terrorism, no more attempt to solve this through military means. To say now that Israel must do something that has never been specified in these documents. In other words, the settlement issue has always, the supposition was that this would always be decided by negotiation. Mm-hmm. To say now that that must be a precondition for the Palestinians to keep the promise that they made back in 1993 is to turn the peace process inside out.
But isn't that the George Mitchell peace process, that there has to be a quid pro quo here, that the settlements have to stop?
The Mitchell plan says that number one, I mean, it does not deviate from the Oslo Accords in this respect. Number one, there must be a complete and total cessation of violence. Mm-hmm. So far, Arafat and the Palestinians have not provided that complete and total cessation of violence. Sharon was first saying that he would insist on that. Then he said he would settle for 7 days of no violence. Then he said he would settle for 48 hours of no violence. And in the end, you know, he gave his approval to Shimon Peres to go and continue negotiating with Arafat. The end of the violence is supposed to be the precondition. And as long as the Palestinians and their spokesmen and defenders keep saying, you can't have peace and we're not going to stop the suicide bombers until you give us what we want, there's nothing to talk about.
I'm sorry, you know, it's very hard to know where to start with Mr. Jacoby's assertions, but one point that I do want to make right at the outset is that my daughter was in school in East Jerusalem. I know that curriculum very well. There's no such thing as hatred.
Oh, please.
It is so well documented.
That's absolutely nonsense.
Well, I have seen that in the press. I have seen articles over the years.
You, Mr. Jacoby, I very much invite you to come to my home. We can go through the books together.
All right, well.
But aside from that, what this entire discussion seems to miss is that there is a longstanding legal framework that precedes the Oslo Accords, that precedes Madrid, that reflects the international law, the international legal position vis-a-vis Israel-Palestine, starting from Resolution 181, which, by the way, the very first resolution Israel has not abided by, and neither has it abided by a single resolution that has come since. We have over 100 affirmations of Resolution 194 alone.
Susan Akron,
you had plenty of opportunity. I need to respond to your point.
All right,
important,
sure.
And they're inaccurate.
But we don't want to get into the infinite regress of resolutions in the past history.
No,
we're trying
very,
to look.
But that's
we're trying to look at
important.
The,
we can't talk outside of a legal framework. You may not. You cannot talk as if Oslo appeared in a vacuum. We are talking about the rights of people here, and if one takes the position that somehow the rights of Israeli Jews are more important than those of Palestinians, I don't start with that premise. Mm-hmm. Every human life is equal, and we have to start from that basis, or there will never be peace in our lifetime.
Well said. Let's take a call from Imran. Hello.
Hi. I guess what I want to understand from the negotiation perspective is that the negotiations always seem to proceed from the facts on the ground, meaning, you know, the settlements that have already been built, the water rights that have already been allocated in one direction or another. But what I would like to know is how come the negotiation never starts from the perspective of the law, which is what the United Nations resolutions are, what international law says, and things of that sort. It's almost as if when you hear the talk of concessions that were made, What doesn't seem right about it is that, you know, concession is something that you give up that you have a right to. And in this case, this is territory and issues that are disputed since 1967, and that becomes the starting point, those facts on the grounds. And, and by the way, I mean, those facts are always increasing because there's always an increasing in settlements and activities and road building and things like that. So I'd like to know why, when you look at the negotiating teams and when they take their positions, it's not brought back to the law, which is, I guess, my main point here.
Okay.
And I'll take it off the air.
Jeff,
I think the short answer is that because that isn't the way that sovereign powers negotiate with each other. When Israel and the Palestinians sat down, when the Prime Minister of Israel and the chairman of the Palestinian Liberation Organization sat down and signed an agreement, that was the binding document. Mm-hmm. And everything proceeds from the words that they have put their names to. The United Nations occasionally does the right thing. I would argue that it much more often does the wrong thing. We saw just a couple of weeks before the September 11 attacks, the festival of anti-Semitism and Israel bashing that took place in Durban, the United Nations Conference Against Racism, so-called. The idea that you would get any sort of international agreement that what the United Nations says is gospel truth and law that must be obeyed at all costs, I think, is simply illusory.
Yeah. In any case, the framework is Oslo, is Camp
David. And there is now a big stack, a big sheaf of documents that have been signed by duly constituted Israeli and Palestinian authorities. And if the parties put their names to those documents, those are the ones that are to be abided by. So far, the Palestinians have not yet kept, as far as I know, any of the major promises that have been made in the Oslo process.
Yet significantly, just within the past couple of weeks, the Palestinian Authority has violently put down Hamas-sponsored demonstrations.
I think something went through Arafat's mind when he saw George W. Bush stand before the U.S. Congress and say, "You're either with us or you're either with the terrorists or you're with us. We are going to root out international terrorism and everyone who sponsors it." I took it seriously then. I'm starting to wonder now, but I think that Arafat probably took it seriously as well. And as you said in your introduction at the beginning of the hour, he's determined not to make the mistake that he made in 1991 when he allied himself so closely with Saddam Hussein. Still, let's remember, when George Bush says now he wants to, his vision includes a Palestinian state and says all the words that the Palestinian Authority wants to hear, what he's really doing is giving a reward to the people who were dancing in the streets and passing out candy when the World Trade Center and the Pentagon were destroyed.
Well, he's also acting like a pragmatic leader of a coalition that is a very delicate business.
You know, I wonder. I agree that coalition building can be delicate, but I also fear that you can get so wrapped up in the cause of assembling a coalition that you lose the moral authority that the coalition is supposed to be based on. And any anti-terror campaign that has us making friends with Iran and Syria and Yasser Arafat is a terror-fighting coalition that I really have my doubts about.
Mike is calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hello.
Yes, hi. Good evening. As an Israeli Jewish American, I think the more important thing here would be to, instead of rehashing the last 100 years of war, to look at the changes going on in Palestinian society. I was reading in the New York Times that the Palestinian police troops, who were ordered to open fire on their own people, came away with feelings, they said it was very strange for them, and that this was something they were not comfortable doing. This, to me, reminded me of Vietnam War protests in the United States in the 1960s, and I am wondering if Yasser Arafat is in danger of losing the little control of power that he has, if the needs and the wishes of those Palestinians, and there are a good number who are supporters of Hamas and who are sympathizing with Osama bin Laden, if those needs are not addressed, can Arafat simply decide to side with the United States, or does he really have? Is he really in the tightest political spot of his life?
Thank you for the question, Mike. Susan Akram?
Yes, I think Mike's question touches on a very interesting point, which goes back to the earlier discussion of what's more important, the politics of an imbalance of power or a more just solution that will last, that will be durable. And if one ignores the international legal framework that really governs the durable solution for this problem, and I might add that in all other major refugee situations around the world, there have been major principles that have been applied consistently, and there are resolutions from the United Nations, although imperfectly applied, when there is a negotiated peace, those principles are incorporated.
Right.
But we have had none of that here. And going back to Mike's issue, in fact, that's precisely why the Intifada broke out, because Oslo and the 7 years of Oslo reflected nothing more than changing facts on the ground to the Israelis' advantage, with none of the guarantees that there would be a just and lasting peace for the Palestinians. And Oslo, as a matter of fact, I happen to have studied these agreements fairly carefully and have written about them. If one looks at those agreements, they violate even the most basic principles of the four Geneva Conventions.
Right.
And this is precisely why the Palestinians have risen up and why they will continue, because they don't see a just solution in sight. And therefore, the politics of power cannot, as evidenced in Oslo, cannot govern this if we want to see a just and lasting peace.
If you were the Israeli government, however, with an Israeli populace that is as frightened of terrorism as we are, how far do you think realistically you could go to meet these the demands of, as you see it and as some Palestinians see it, of justice? I mean, should they be willing unilaterally to call in all the settlements? Should they call in some settlements? Should they agree to Jerusalem? What would it take?
Well, at an absolute minimum, I mean, I don't know if you're aware that in the 7 years of Oslo, there were more settlements built than in the 10 years before. So, you know, one just starts from there and says there have been changing facts on the ground that must be halted immediately. I would say at an absolute minimum, complying with the many UN resolutions that have required withdrawing from the occupied territories, that must happen.
Mm-hmm.
It has to happen now.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually is a huge, would be a huge confidence-building measure to go beyond. Even that, not only has that not been complied with, but more land has been taken. 4,000 Palestinian homes have been demolished.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when one talks about violence, one excludes, in normal parlance, in this country, one excludes the violence that's being done on an absolute daily basis to the Palestinians, stealing their water, demolishing their lands, ripping up their olive groves, their sources of subsistence, let alone the closures and all the rest of it.
So you think at a minimum it would take an end to all future
absolutely.
Settlements and a rescinding of past settlements,
absolutely.
Essentially calling, going in between back to pre-67 borders.
Of course.
All right. Hold on to that thought for a minute, Susan Akram. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or get into the conversation online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Jack Beatty. You're listening to Special Coverage, WBUR Boston.
From Boston University.
This is Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Jack Beatty. We're talking about the hot-button issue of the creation of a Palestinian state. Have you changed your position since September 11th? Could the war on terrorism be the catalyst for new negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians? What role should the U.S. play? Join the conversation, 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-TALK, 423-8255. Jeff Jacoby, just before the break, Susan raised the issue, Susan Akram raised the issue of the settlements and how that would play into the peace process and so on. Let's just move on just one step. What do you think are the prospects for peace now? Many people are saying, of course, that things are in motion that weren't in motion before, namely that the U.S. has to show something to the Arab governments that it's moving ahead, that Arafat seems to have got the message, as you yourself have upset that he's got to be on the train or it's going to leave the station, and that in short, that there's a kind of momentum building. Do you think it can reach all the way? Do you think, more specifically, that Sharon is the man to reach across the table to Arafat?
I think if it were going to be done by anybody, it would be done by Sharon. The Nixon to China syndrome would probably come into play. But I got to tell you, I'm very pessimistic. I think that after what we've seen in Israel over the past 12 months, the incredible wave of terrorism and violence directed against Israeli civilians by a Palestinian leadership that had so much offered to it, makes me think that in the end, you can't make peace with people who don't want to make peace with you. Anybody who spends time with Israelis knows how strong and fervent the desire for peace is. Indeed, there's no precedent in world history for a victorious power making the kinds of offers and concessions and withdrawals and surrendering the kind of territory that the Israelis have done to the Palestinians. And it stems from this, what was at one point a very widespread sentiment among the Israelis: we've got to bring an end to this, we'll do whatever it takes. Ehud Barak tried to do whatever it took, and that apparently still wasn't enough. I think that there has to be some kind of a sea change in the mentality, the psychology, the outlook, the attitude of Palestinians. As long as they are ruled by somebody who is the very icon of terror himself, Yasser Arafat, and who rules the Palestinian Authority with dictatorial powers, I can't see how peace is ever going to have a chance to set down roots.
But Itzhak Rabin himself said, you make peace with your enemies. Arafat is the enemy. He has been the enemy. You make
exactly
peace with
right.
your enemies.
It's a beautiful sounding...
You don't reach out and decide who your peace partners are eliminating all
but you
of
can
the
only
other,
make
all of the others.
You only make peace with your enemies in two circumstances. One is when you have convincingly and totally defeated your enemy, as we did to Germany and Japan in World War II. The other is when your enemy decides that he's prepared and serious to make peace with you, and in that case, he's no longer your enemy. Mm-hmm. The Israelis have never been willing to go and utterly crush and destroy the Palestinians, and I don't think anybody doubts that if they really set out to annihilate the Palestinians, they could do it in about 20 minutes.
At the destruction of their own whole national identity and everything they stand for.
No, I'm just saying in terms of military power, if the Israelis wanted to destroy the Palestinians, they could do it. But of course, they're never going to do that. Nor is there the other option, the signs from the Palestinians that there is a genuine willingness to make peace. Listen, on the day that Oslo was signed, I remember I was at the White House South Lawn, September 13, 1993, watching this thing take place. The air of optimism was so thick you could have spread it on butter. And yet I found out later, you know, the transcript showed up a few days later, that very day Arafat was giving interviews in Arabic to Arabic language radio and television stations, in which he was saying, don't worry, the plan of phases of 1974 is still in force. Now, I'm sure not one of our listeners in 100 knows what the plan of phases is, but it's absolute basic Palestinian doctrine, which says we'll take as much as land as we can get through negotiation, and we'll use that as the staging ground until we've liberated all of Israel. If he was saying that on the day that Oslo began, what hope is there really that he's interested in peace?
I just want to make a couple of quick points. First of all, that the Palestinians are absolutely desperate for peace. And if anyone doesn't know this yet, terrorism springs from hopelessness. And when a people have gone through, as much of the Palestinians have, had their lands, their homes, their livelihood taken from them, and that continues to be taken to this day, and who have really, although they have the law on their side, have had absolutely no support for their very just and legitimate struggle. I want to remind people just a few basics, which is that when Israel was established, the Resolution 181 gave 56% of the territory that was historic Palestine to a Jewish population that comprised less than one-third of the entire population and that owned no more than 7% of the land in Palestine. Now, how they were able to accomplish the takeover,
Susan,
was through massive destruction.
And what was the response of the Arab world to that United Nations decision?
Through destruction of over 200 cities and villages.
Susan, are you hopeful? Do you think there's an opening here for peace?
I'm suggesting that there was an opening at Oslo. There's an opening now because the Palestinians are desperate for peace. They are no different than anybody else on the face of the earth. They want basic justice, and basic rights and a place to live in dignity.
Jeff Jacoby, briefly.
You know, we're not going to rehash and settle the entire history of the Israeli-Palestinian dispute here. When the United Nations voted to partition Palestine and create Israel, the international law that Susan Akram keeps referring to, the response of the entire Arab world was to invade the brand new state of Israel and attempt to wipe it out. Everything we've seen since then is really just an echo of that, and we're living with it today.
History hangs over
and,
all of this.
And the war of terrorism, against terrorism that we're trying to fight, has to be separated,
Jeff,
from this intractable dispute.
Thank you for that intractable last thought. Thank you, Susan Akram and Jeff Jacoby. Susan Akram is a professor of law at Boston University. She spent last year teaching at the Palestinian School of Law in East Jerusalem. Jeff Jacoby is a columnist for the Boston Globe. You can continue the conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Now to the uncertain skies. September 11th was a setback, not just for the airlines, but for the people who are already afraid to fly. Special Coverage correspondent Jonathan Salzman reports.
A lot of people have been jittery about flying since September 11th. But what happens if you were already a white-knuckle flyer when you saw those TV images of a hijacked airliner crashing into the World Trade Center? One in six Americans said they had a fear of flying before the terrorist attacks, according to experts. Carol Lang of Queens was one of them. The 55-year-old elementary school teacher refused to fly for 32 years, even though she wanted to visit Europe with friends.
I developed a, I guess you could call it a real phobia. And if someone said to me, listen, Carol, the whole group of us is going to Paris over Easter vacation and we'd like you to come with us. And I would say, well, I can't because I can't get on the plane.
But recently, Lang spent about $350 on a fear of flying program given by a former airline captain and licensed therapist from Connecticut. A series of tape-recorded mental exercises plus an hour of counseling on the phone with the reassuring therapist were so effective, she was able to fly to Atlanta in July and take five other flights this summer. After she saw the World Trade Center towers burning from the window of her school, however, Lang canceled a trip to visit her old college friend in Atlanta. She wants to reschedule it, but is afraid of more terrorism.
Well, I did overcome this, and I did feel, you see, I felt safe flying. And as far as the mechanics of flying, as far as trusting the pilots, as far as trusting the airplane and its ability to keep me safe, I was secure in that. But I didn't know that I wasn't safe because of all the things that were happening are happening in the world. And that's what's shaking me now.
Therapists who treat the fear of flying, one of the most common phobias, say lots of people are reacting the same way, or worse. In the first 2 weeks after the terrorist attacks, several support groups for frightened flyers across the country canceled sessions because clients stopped coming. Alan Strohmayer, a behavioral therapist who runs Calm Flight in White Plains for business executives, says his phone stopped ringing.
There was nothing. There was no business for fear of flying. My colleagues in psychology who were doing routine evaluations, there was none of that. The school evaluations ceased. People were just in shock. Everybody's anxiety level has been raised a notch. So the people that were already afraid to fly are now very afraid to fly. And the people that were on the border have crossed over the border. And the people that were below threshold for fear of flying now may be afraid of being hijacked. That's different than being afraid of flying. They have a fear of, I could be hijacked and blown up, crashed into a building, driven into the ground. You know, to pick your poison.
Therapists say it's common for nervous flyers to avoid getting on an airliner for weeks or months after a widely publicized crash. But the unprecedented carnage on September 11th is having a more profound effect. In a Harris Interactive poll of more than 4,600 adults shortly after the attacks, 64% of those who responded said they would be afraid to fly in the next several days. 37% said they would probably avoid flying for the next few months. In a survey of corporate travel managers by the Business Travel Coalition, 165 of 187 companies, 88%, said they expected employees to cut back on travel. Business travelers are the airline's most lucrative passengers, generating 40 to 60% of the industry's revenue.
Well, I think what's happened now is very different than anything we've ever had, certainly in our lifetime, if not several generations.
Geralyn Ross is the president of the Anxiety Disorders Association of America and a clinical social worker in Washington, D.C.
When there's been a plane crash, it's always a horrible tragedy, but it's usually a one-time event, and what most people tend to do is rationalize things like, well, I wouldn't have been on that airplane, or I wouldn't have flown in this kind of weather, or, well, what's happened now is, with this horrible thing that's happened, is that there hasn't been any closure. So people can't say, okay, well, now it's a safer time to fly. And number two, a lot of people, the way it happened and the flights that were on, regular, scheduled flights, and it was on a beautiful day, people are saying it could have been me.
Which gets to another point. Some therapists say it's perfectly rational for folks like Carol Lang, the schoolteacher from Queens, to be scared about the possibility of more terrorism on planes. They distinguish between a reasonable fear of another hijacking from the garden variety flying phobia, which is often bound up with fears of claustrophobia and loss of control. Indeed, Tom Bunn, the former airline captain and the therapist who counseled Lang, says he's recommending people don't fly for now, even though he feels flying in general is the safest way to travel.
I myself am not flying right now, and that's because security was really very poor before September 11th. Since September 11th, it's been increased. The security has been increased, but not to the level where it's really adequate. I really think that any terrorist who wanted to get on an airplane would have very little difficulty doing it, even now.
Bunn bases his opinion on his experience as a pilot. He says cockpit doors need to be strengthened to keep out hijackers. Air marshals should be put on planes, and baggage screeners should be rigorously vetted federal employees, all measures that Congress is weighing. But what happens if you're still nervous about flying, even after security is improved? Geralyn Ross of the Anxiety Disorders Association of America says she's telling patients she still feels flying is extremely safe, especially now because of heightened security. But the decision to board a plane is a personal one, she says. If jittery patients do decide to fly, they should try to increase their sense of control as much as possible.
One of the things I tell people is to take control in situations where they can have some control. For example, they should know that if they're going on a flight and they get to the airport and they walk through the metal detector and they have something in their own, personal baggage that hadn't been picked up, which makes them think, well, they're not really being careful. Go and find a supervisor and say, this is what happened. Or if they're on an airplane and they see somebody or in the airport that looks like a, shady character and, at the risk of erring on the side of maybe offending somebody, I would go to an authority. I would go to a police. I would go to, the flight attendant if it's on a plane or somebody and let them know I'm uncomfortable.
Ross says she hasn't flown since September 11th, but that's because her flight from National Airport in Washington was canceled.
I have some flights coming up in the next couple of weeks, and I'm just going to look at each one. This is what I tell my patients, too. I'm going to look at each one and think, is this something that I want to do? Would I take a frivolous flight like sometimes I'll do, let's just jump on a plane and go away for the weekend? Probably not. If there's something that I wanted to do, involving family or something for work that I felt was really super important, yeah, I would.
For WBUR special coverage, I'm Jonathan Saltzman.
For comprehensive coverage of the U.S. war on terrorism, go to our website. Log on to WBUR.org and click on special coverage. I'm Jack Beatty. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston.